sick of the silence, bound by violence. You're not alone, you're not guilty of violence, just driven from silence. You're not alone.
On February 25th, the Oakland chapter of Critical Resistance held an event at the Eastside Cultural Center to celebrate the release of the 19th issue of The Abolitionist, a publication dedicated to the abolition of the strategy and practice of the prison industrial complex. This event was titled Strong Minds and Strong Movements and invited people to join in on a discussion about how policing, surveillance, and imprisonment compromise our mental health and the ways that organizing can keep us connected, healthy, and strong. Critical Resistance had invited Azadeh Zarabi of Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition, Aurora Lopez of the Chicano Moratorium Coalition, and Claude Marx, a former political prisoner and founder of Freedom Archives. To listen to the full audio of the evening, please check out radioautonomia.wordpress.com. This audio will begin with the introduction by Isaac Ontiveros and Rachel Erzig of Critical Resistance, framing the night and breaking down the theme and importance of this current issue. The second part of the audio is Aurora Lopez, Azadeh Zarabi, and then Claude Marx answering the question, when you think about some of the impacts of imprisonment, surveillance, and the prison industrial complex are on our health and well-being, especially of our psychological and mental health, what do you think of? And then the second part of the question is, what are some of the things that contribute to our resilience and our ability to stay healthy?
Welcome to Eastside Arts Cultural Center. My name is Isaac Monteveros, and I'm here speaking on behalf of the Oakland Chapter of Critical Resistance. We wanted to thank you all for coming tonight. As you know, you were here for this event, Strong Minds, Strong Movements, and what the event really is about is to celebrate the launch of the most recent issue of the Abolitionist newspaper. This paper goes, its primary audience is people inside prisons and jails and detention centers. It goes inside to over 3,000 prisoners who are regular subscribers to the paper, and you'll see that some of them are regular contributors to the paper. And as we know, the way things work inside of prisons is for every one prisoner that gets the paper, we could probably count several others at very least who read it. And we are definitely in dialogue with folks inside who use it as, you know, study material and so on and discuss it. And so we are proud to help that dialogue that's happening across the wire, as it were. If you look at the issue of this paper, you'll see that there's a theme, and the theme is mental health, and you'll see the name of tonight's event is Strong Minds, Strong Movements. And so we're very proud to have some speakers that we'll introduce in a second, but for us it was important to put this issue out. When we think about the prison industrial complex, when we think about the relationship among policing, surveillance, imprisonment, the courts, and also, you know, the economic and social harms that are supported and that the prison industrial complex supports, we often can think a lot about the physical violence that happens to people inside prisons and to our communities and so on. What this paper wants to highlight is also the psychological harm that happens, right? So that as much as the prison industrial complex is about capturing bodies, killing people, it's also about attacking our mental health along with our physical health. At the same time, when we try to do political work, when we work with our friends and families and coworkers, when we build and participate in political organizations, our struggle is not just to get our bodies free, but our minds free. And so that's an important issue and something that maybe is important for us to continuously remind ourselves. And we all have different ways of understanding what it means to have a strong heart, spirit, and so on, and strong minds. And so we encourage you to read the paper.
I just want to start by saying that this issue of the paper, like so many of the issues that will be coming out of the paper, is really a combination of input from imprisoned people and the people who are working on the issues on the outside. And the issue of mental health is really, really key, I think, to a lot of us. And there are ways in which we understand the prison industrial complex, the effects of imprisonment and policing and surveillance and the courts. And all of us can see in the day-to-day how that stuff strips away our dignity, how it strips away our integrity, how it strips away our ability to form bonds with people that help us stay healthy and well and secure. And, you know, when you get locked in a cage and you are isolated and deprived of the kinds of connections and relationships and stimulation that help keep your mind sharp, help increase your ability to fight, or when you are trailed out on the street, harassed, pushed up against a wall, or worse, you know, clubbed to the back of the head, pepper spray in the face, when you're under constant surveillance, you start to have a question about whether or not your own reality as you experience it is true. And I think there are a lot of forces out there that tell you that it is actually not true, right? What you believe is not true. What you are fighting for is not true. And so I think, you know, one of the things that we wanted to do with the issue, and particularly with this conversation, is not to talk about all of the really terrible things that happen as a result of the prison industrial complex. I think we have a really good sense of all the terrible things that happen as a result of the prison industrial complex. And so, you know, we'll touch on some of those things because the details of how things are happening in our world in terms of imprisonment, policing, and surveillance are key. But we really do want to spend a lot of time tonight talking about what it means to fight back and the ability to fight back being really key to keeping our minds sharp, to keeping our bodies healthy, to staying resilient so that we can keep fighting. I'm going to start out by asking a question of each of them, but then we aren't going to do round robin questions if we can avoid it. We'd like to just keep it flowing. But Aurora, I'm going to start with you. And I think where I want to start is just by asking each of you, when you think about what some of the impacts of imprisonment and policing and surveillance, the prison industrial complex, are on our health and well-being, especially our psychological and mental health, what do you think of? But then also, what are some of the things that you think contribute to our resilience and our ability to stay healthy?
So first of all, thank you, everyone who was able to make it. Thank you for the editors that put this newspaper together. I'm really, really excited about this topic. This is something that I feel like is very near and dear to my heart. It has a lot to do with why I decided to go into public health as an organizer. And just thank you for the invitation, Rachel, and the rest of the CR team. I think, we can't talk about the context of this work and about health without really, really diving into the root causes of poor health, right? And within that, really focusing on the fact that a lot of the work that is happening throughout the city, a lot of the attacks that have been happening throughout our communities of color are really linked to oppression, right? These systems of oppression, when we talk about racism, when we talk about these manifestations into violence. And, you know, I've been driven back to really think about, like, what are the contributors to health? What are these different things that really impact who we are? And, you know, you look at the books and it says healthcare, access to healthcare, genetics, and lifestyle is another one of them. And so when we think about lifestyle, we think about what influences what how we act, right? What influences what we do, and what are the decisions that we take to really take care of ourselves. And we can't really talk about lifestyle without looking at these policies, right? Without looking at how these wider institutions are addressing health. And that's the way that I look at it. I look at health not just as mental health, but you can't separate your mind from your body, from your spirit. And in the work that I've been doing with the Chicano Moratorium Coalition, we've been really working with young people to not just liberate their minds, but also their spirits, right? And when we talk about imprisonment, not just talking about being behind bars, but as it was mentioned, what does that imprisonment look like when we're attacked every single day, when young people are attacked at school with an unjust education, right, in our homes, and also with the policing that is continuously surrounding us. I think one of the main examples that I can think about as a way that resistance has really been at the forefront of improving our health has been with the gang injunctions, right? We've been able to work with community folks, right, that were labeled as defendants in this case, and really to see them and look at all the different attacks that they were facing in their homes, surveillance, being harassed on the streets, in their jobs, and having them really turn it around and become organizers and start really manifesting their visions into the community. One main example is putting murals into this neighborhood has been one way that we've been able to see them really giving back, and in turn seeing a whole different transformation in their spirit, right, in their mind, and how they are able to contribute to society, to our community. That's one main example that I can think of right now, but I think the work that I've been able to do with young people throughout Oakland and in the Bay Area has been about that. It has been about not just liberating our minds, but our bodies and our spirit. And I have a lot to say, but I want to pass this on, and then we can continue the conversation.
Thank you. So the way I'm going to speak about mental health is from my personal experience, and that is first back up to childhood when both of my parents were political prisoners in Iran. And the only way that I'm sitting in front of you is because my mother had the courage to escape prison. So escape prison, escape Iran, end up here. Trying to understand that whole process and what happened, why that happened, led me to read a lot about political prisoners in this country. And part of me building resilience or figuring out how I was going to deal with the trauma of having to escape Iran, escape prison, and then grow up with parents who were dealing with their own trauma after going through that experience. The only way that I was able to understand that for myself was through connecting with the stories of political prisoners here, because I was here and it was something that I felt like I could connect to and something I felt like I could do something about. Later, my brother was sent to prison, and he's been in for over 10 years. He's been in the security housing unit for almost 6 years now. And that's when I really noticed that when he went in, I was expecting that there would be mental health consequences, because I had already been involved in the anti-prison movement, and I knew sending someone to isolation for a very long time had serious consequences, because I saw my parents go through it. But I wasn't expecting it to affect my mental health the way it did. I was more preparing myself to be there for him and to just be the best support system I could. And it wasn't until a few months into it that I was really realizing that this is beyond him. It's really having a serious impact on me, and I had to go get help for it because it wasn't something that I knew how to deal with myself. And I didn't, at that time I was a university student, not as connected with the movement because I had pulled back so I could finish school. And I didn't really have that network of activists around me or that sense of community. So it was really me and my family. Coming out of that, finally finishing school, being able to go to law school and feel like that's something that I was doing that was further building my resilience and further building my capacity to fight something that I felt was wrong and something that I felt that impacted me greatly. That's where I started feeling a little relief in terms of my own mental health discomfort. I started feeling like there's progress being made. I'm connected with folks that are doing the same work. I saw myself as part of I saw myself in a historical context and realized that this is part of a bigger picture, that I completely was not alone as I started meeting more family members. And now it's really the same thing, like just the ability to connect with other people who see see the problem the way that we do and see that it is a problem, and people that are committed to fighting the problem is pretty much what keeps me like able to continue functioning and doing it. Some days it's easier than others. There's some things I know I can't do. Like today I got a letter from my brother and I knew I couldn't open it before I came here because I don't know what it's gonna say, and if it says something that, you know, it could say something to where I read it and I'm not able to speak on this panel afterwards. So like, there's things that I know, I like boundaries and limits I have to set with myself so that I'm able to continue, but definitely like 90% of it is just knowing that I have people around me that are committed to fighting it and knowing that there's progress being made and that my work is contributing to that. So I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation. Thank you.
It's really great being here, both because there's some familiar faces and some new ones. The first public event I went to while I was still in Halfway House was the first Critical Resistance Conference, which on one hand was really inspiring, on the other hand, I couldn't deal with that many people. And it wasn't until I sat down with a brother who passed not that long ago, Geronimo Gijaga, who kind of talked me into a space where I could deal with it enough to actually participate in a panel that I was a part of. So I'm very appreciative of what's been built over the years in terms of a prison support movement and a level of consciousness, which is what brings us here. The most natural thing to do when you're locked in a cage is to resist. Nobody's happy living that kind of life. And the role of the prison is to destroy that resistance, physically and mentally. And the way that you can survive is by hanging on to your humanity and touching other people. I don't mean just physically, but I mean what you can build, which I can only speak for myself. For men is a very challenging thing, and it actually happens in prison more than it does on the street. On one hand, there you are, you know, where somebody else is controlling everything from when the lights go on and off to when you can eat and, you know, whether your toilet's gonna work or not, or all that stuff that you probably can imagine. But the resistance is about the human relationships that exist inside. And sometimes that resistance gets raised to a collective level, which we're seeing today here in California in the prisons. And what makes that happen is to not see the repression as being something that only individuals deal with, but as a part of a collective experience. And in a way, we need to understand that because we need to be building that out here as well. And, you know, I don't have to tell you that the resistance is exactly what is being, you know, that's why there's a gang injunction, or that's what the intent is. Or that's why flooding the communities with cops, or turning our schools into prisons. That's about destroying that human quality that searches for a more humane way of relating and a way for communities to build a level of self-reliance and self-determination is exactly what the state wants to smash. That's why COINTELPRO smashed organizations and movements. That's why they took out leaders who represented both the literal embodiment and ability to mobilize people, but also the potential for there to be something created by us that would change the power relations that exist in this country and have from its very inception. And so, anybody who's resisting is a part of the same resistance that has been experienced and put forward and mobilized for, starting with the indigenous people who were, you know, living this land before anybody from Europe ever came, to people who were forced in slavery to come, or when borders got changed in Mexico, where we are, is no longer, or Ohlone land, or anything else. I mean, this is what we've seen, and that's a very liberating thing to understand, and it's very dangerous to teach that. It's dangerous to teach it in the street, and it's dangerous even more so to teach it in the prison. So when we see these things being written by prisoners, and when they are able to read things like The Abolitionist or anything else for that matter, that represents the greatest danger to the stability of the prison that can exist. Consciousness, a consciousness that's about not individuals, but about collective power.
To donate or subscribe to The Abolitionists, please check out abolitionistpaper.wordpress.com. And to find more about and stay updated with Critical Resistance, check out criticalresistance.org. To listen to the full audio of the evening, please check out radioautonomia.wordpress.com.
After I saw you all around.